I want to just give you a couple of words as we begin this. Two things. One, all conversations, all tables, all parties, every gathering, they're all open. So you see a group of people walking off to some certain table, if you're wondering whether you're invited to that table, the practice has been, yes, it certainly is. We're people, one of the grounding things that calls us together is this desire for friendship. Subversive friendships, sustaining friendships, aim toward the new in Christ. And so this is what we're here for, and we want you to know that every single one of those gatherings is open to everyone. And the second thing is the time is short. This thing goes by fast. So if you have questions you came to ask or something you're wondering, ask it. And let's enjoy this time together and make sure that you get what you came here for and even more. So thanks be to God for this gathering.
Well, in the fall, we sent out a survey that many of you may have filled out about the theme this year and what we were hoping for. It seems like it's not on. Okay, now better. Okay, thank you. And one of the surveys that most struck us was our plenary speaker Joel survey. And so I don't know if you're aware, but those surveys and different conversations really have shaped the gathering. It's not just the two of us. There's a bunch of people that have shaped it. And Joel is one of those people. Some of what I was preaching came out of reading his survey. So we're just super grateful for him to begin. In talking with him and looking at that, we just felt like he would be a really good person to begin what we hoped we would be about for this time. And so Roy's going to more fully introduce Joel.
I just want to interpret that statement about it's not Cindy and I. She's trying to say it's not our fault for anything that goes on from this point forward. But I want to introduce Joel. Joel Schumann is a most improbable moral theologian. And he has the signatures of five old guys from Duke University to prove it. He grew up on a farm in West Virginia in a household where the saints were Mother Jones, Eugene Debs, Clarence Darrow, and Sal Alinsky, and where there were always lots of books. He did undergraduate work at Bethany College, and when his mediocre athletic career was cut mercifully short by injury, he decided to become a physical therapist, mostly because he couldn't see himself going to school long enough to become a physician. Boy, was that some seriously misbegotten reasoning. Somewhere along the way, he was captivated by Christianity and started reading theology, philosophy, and lots of literature, and oh yeah, the Bible. That's a strange book, isn't it? Then he heard about Stanley Hauerwas, read The Politics of Jesus, and freaked out his wife and kids by announcing his intention to move to North Carolina to get a PhD in theological ethics. The rest is history, and for the past 15 years, he's taught theology at King's College in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where his work focuses on bioethics and broadly construed. He lives with Chris, his wife of almost 36 years, Agnes the cat, and Wendell, the almost famous three-legged dog. He and Chris are parents of three genuinely amazing, mostly adult children, parents-in-law of a couple should-be saints, and grandparents of two super cool grandsons, Elijah and Noah, one of whom gave Joel a Black Lives Matter yard sign for Christmas, one of those double dog dare gifts. He remains a disaffected Methodist, having been duped into thinking Aldersgate Church in Chapel Hill was a representative congregation. The Ecclesia Project has been letting him hang out around here for a long time, probably as a gesture of super arrogatory, I can't even say that word. That's why I'm sitting next to theologians. He wouldn't have it any other way. We want to invite to the pulpit, podium, Joel Schumann.
Thank you. So, as Roy said, I'm from West Virginia. Let's hear it. I I'll tell you what I tell my students, because it's really the only reason that might be relevant for this context, and that is, because I'm from West Virginia, I'm liable at any time to lapse into a thick, mostly unintelligible Appalachian accent. If I do that, know that I'm smarter than I sound. On the other hand, I have an affinity for Latinate polysyllables. And if I start doing that, know that I'm probably not nearly as smart as I sound. The other thing I wanted to mention was that even the survey thing, that should be a cautionary tale to you. It's still surprising to me because vulnerability's not really my bag. I mean, it doesn't come naturally, even though I'm feeling kind of vulnerable. My oldest child turns 35 next week. And kind of when your kid turns 35, there's no denying your mortality any longer. And I scheduled bilateral knee replacements for December too, so, yeah. So, there are two ways, and there's a great difference between the two ways. Those words I offer as a touchstone for my remarks this afternoon, they're excerpted from the first sentence of an ancient Christian catechetical document called the Didache. Most scholars believe the Didache was written in the late first century, well before Christians had become accustomed to power and its trappings. When faithfulness to the gospel was obviously costly, and the enemies of Christianity were more real than contrived. Things have since become just a little more complicated. The Didache's two ways are not always as obviously distinguishable as they once were. Christianity still has enemies, of course. And though in parts of the world those enemies are every bit as obvious and vicious as Rome ever was, those of us trying to be Christian here in the United States and much of the so-called developed world often struggle rightly to name the real foes of the gospel. That's not to say we don't have enemies. They're simply harder to identify, for they pursue a subtler strategy. In trying to name them, we might do well to consider the words of that great historical icon, Pogo the Possum,
amen,
who famously said, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Chief among the enemies of Christianity in our culture is, well, Christianity in our culture. Walter Brueggemann described that almost 40 years ago as so largely enculturated to the American ethos of consumerism that it has little power to believe or to act. Our consciousness, he went on to add, has been claimed by false fields of perception and idolatrous systems of language and rhetoric. Many of us have more than once read or heard our friend Stanley Hauerwas say that the first task of the church is to make the world the world. But that task presumes the church's ability to recognize the world as strange and itself as alien to the world. How can we do that when we're so thoroughly committed in ways that exceed our choosing and defy our recognizing to the world's accounts of meaning and success and security? The Trappist monk Thomas Merton once said, "Your life is shaped by the end you live for. You're made in the image of what you desire." Having just quoted the Didache, not to mention Pogo, I find those words disconcerting because it's seldom clear to me just what end I am living for. My life tends toward a kind of sequential polytheism. As I find myself pulled this way and that way by my desires for all kinds of things, including some very good things. The gospel of the kingdom, if I'm honest, is sometimes nowhere near the top of the list. Now, don't get me wrong, I believe in the gospel. I care about it deeply, but I seldom seek it first the way I'm supposed to. Where faithfulness is concerned, my most troublesome enemies are my desires and the forces that shape them. But there's more to Father Merton's assertion than a not-so-subtle reminder of the ease with which we slip into various idolatries or turn down the wrong road. His words also call attention to some of the most basic elements of our lives and the ways those elements intertwine, the multitude of things to which we're drawn and those we elect to pursue, the company we keep and the ways we keep it, and the lives to which we aspire, not simply for ourselves, but also for our children, who are for good and for ill frequently mirrors to ourselves. If these things are as essential as Merton suggests, and I think they are, then they're worth asking questions of. Why do we want the things we do? How should we think about whether and how to pursue those things? What are we willing to do on our own behalf and that of our children to achieve the lives we envision ourselves and them living? Precisely what kinds of things are we allowing ourselves and teaching our children to want? All of these questions point in the general direction of formation. Formation, as I'm using the word here, is predicated on the notion that we are what the philosopher Gabriel Marcel called homo viator, man and woman on the way, always in a state of becoming the people we are with the desires we have, a process that is in part a function of an intricate constellation of social forces. Now, formation is language that we in the Ecclesia Project are extremely comfortable with. It's become a big part of who we are and what we try to do. Words like discipleship, practices, virtues, and character flow freely among us. And we're forever asking how we might more effectively allow ourselves and our communities to be formed and help form others as faithful disciples of Jesus, members of his body, and heralds of the new creation. I suspect that there are few here who would wish it otherwise, and I have absolutely no interest in challenging that aspect of our identity. What I would like to question, though, are some of our more facile assumptions about formation. Not to put too fine a point on it, but much of what we call formation just happens, sometimes perforce, but more often, as Annie Dillard says, by hap, like the words of songs. Formation is constant, ubiquitous, nearly Byzantine in its complexity. We all swim in a sea of formative influences that prompt us, more or less forcefully, more or less explicitly, to want certain things, to be certain kinds of people, to aspire to certain kinds of lives. These are the voices in our heads and the texts before our eyes, from the instant we awaken right up to the moment we fall asleep, like some bizarre parody of Jesus. They are with us always, presumably even to the end of the age. Were we able to name them all, we could still not expel them from our consciousness or escape their influence. Because there's so many, they defy easy categorization. Some maybe not as many as we'd like? Are adiaphora matters of moral and theological indifference? But many of the forces that influence us genuinely matter because they press us one direction or another, making it more or less difficult to live lives conformed to the one who calls us to love God and neighbor in all that we do. What they have in common is their often tacit reliance upon some vision or another of the good life and the accoutrements that simultaneously make that life possible and evidence its achievement. It's all but impossible to speak in our milieu of the good life and its trappings without some mention of consumerism, of course. Low-hanging fruit, that. Consumerism, of course, is on the one hand the name we give to a market economy that is driven by presumably infinitely expanding desire for consumer goods and services. It's also an occasionally pejorative way of naming consumption as an ideology, as a way of life, one that I characterized to my undergraduates as buy stuff, be happy. Buy more stuff, be happier. Buy it all, be supremely happy. We're not. The two senses are, of course, connected, and Pope Francis levels a withering critique at both in his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Gaudium, saying, for instance, that our uncritical participation in the consumer economy of exclusion and inequality leads to a complacent yet covetous heart, the feverish pursuit of frivolous pleasures, and a blunted conscience. Ouch. Much more could be said about consumerism in another context, and with a bit more time, I'd like to do so. But what I find most significant about this monster, for our purposes here at least, is the normative anthropology, that is, the account of what it means to be human, that it both presumes and prescribes. Consumerism depends for its vitality on our being certain kinds of people. While at the same time, gently, or maybe not so gently, nudging us toward becoming ever more that way. You can argue without too much simplification, I think, that there's a relative straightforward continuity that extends from the first positing of humans as rational individuals living unencumbered by others in a state of nature, to the assertion of autonomous rational will as the essence of human being, to the belief that being human is a matter of having the freedom to choose which stuff to buy, from whom, in order to expedite the fulfillment of one's freely chosen vision of the good life. The most obvious features of this broad account of what it means to be human are familiar to most of us. Humans are rational individuals with the capacity to choose, and that capacity being central to our humanness should be underwritten. But there are other aspects of this anthropology that are less obvious, yet no less dearly held. If you and I are in our essence free, rational individuals, then we are essentially unencumbered by attachments to particular people and places. Such attachments are things we choose, and we freely, but usually provisionally, enter into them only when it is rational to do so. In the mode of thinking that ends at consumerism, rational tends to code for self-interested. The rational agent will always act in what she understands to be her own self-interest. When we rationally choose to attach ourselves to people or places, it's because we think they, like certain cars or consumer electronics or prescription pharmaceuticals, will contribute to the realization of what we take to be our freely chosen vision of the good life. Our thinking about these people and places is largely instrumental. They're means to our ends, resources to be mined or otherwise extracted, and when depleted, abandoned. But what of people and places that the rational actor does not freely choose? Clearly, it's wise to be wary of them, for they may prove to be encumbrances or obstacles to achieving the lives we wish to live. For instance, by placing unwelcome demands on our time, depleting our scarce resources, competing with us for desirable opportunities. When and to the extent they come to represent these things to us, they're potential enemies who must be met and treated accordingly, lest they cause our lives to turn out differently than we'd like. Of course, this way of thinking, these machinations, are undeniably partly about pleasure seeking. Who wants to change diapers when you could be watching Game of Thrones? I've never seen Game of Thrones, but it's a big deal, I hear. But it's a mistake to reduce self-interestedness to hedonism, to hedonics. A better way of naming the end of this way of thinking and acting is security. Security is a hedge against contingency. It's something that happens to me, contingency. It's something over which I typically have little or no control. Unhappy contingency is the potentially deadly enemy of realizing the good life because it makes me vulnerable. And this sort of vulnerability is to be avoided. Just so, the rational actor has to seek as much control as possible over the circumstances of his existence. He has to minimize the likelihood of all manner of unhappy contingency so as to secure the life he's building or aspires to build. This is the logic of enterprises running the gamut from the advertising industry to national security policy. And if you allow your imagination to run free for a moment, I'm sure you can think of a half dozen or more ways its habits of thought and speech and action are at work in the world we inhabit. There's an important sense in which none of this is really that new or even recent. If you take away the accidents of history and the particulars of political economy, these habits of being are really quite ancient. We have a name for them in Christian tradition. Sin. It's not the way women and men have been made to live, but rather the way we turn when we are alienated from our true end, which is friendship with God. St. Augustine used a lovely simile to describe those of us in this state. He said, we were like a heart turned in on itself. The Didache's description is a bit starker, saying that those whose lives were invested in the pursuit of their own interests rather than the love of God of neighbor were living the way of death. There's more to say about the central tenets of the two ways and their respective politics, but rather than entering straight away into the business of trying to explain them, I want to take a cue from Wittgenstein and try to show them to you with a little help from some good friends and that most astute observer of human condition, William Shakespeare. Although he was no theologian and perhaps not even a Christian, Shakespeare's imagination was thoroughly shaped by scripture and his writing filled with biblical and theological allusions. I want to draw on a scene from one of his plays to try to show the two ways and some of the respective consequences. And because drama is meant to be performed rather than explained, which I don't have the chops to do anyway, I've seen fit to exploit the talents of the aforementioned friends. The Royal Shakespeare Company was not available, but in their stead, we have an only slightly less accomplished troupe. I give to you the not quite royal, but still pretty darn good Shakespeare Company. They, or I should say we, we'll be reading an excerpt from Act 1, Scene 1 of the tragedy King Lear, a scene that's sometimes called the love auction. And by way of introducing them, allow me to offer a bit of framework. The scene takes place in the court of King Lear, the aging king of Britain, who will be played by Brian Volk. Lear has grown tired of the duties of monarchy and has decided to retire and divide his kingdom among his three daughters. To his immediate left will be his eldest daughter, Goneril, played by Kelly Johnson, who is married to the Duke of Albany. On her left is his second daughter, Regan, played by Tracy Lysaght, who is married to the Duke of Cornwall. Neither of Lear's two son-in-laws has yet received his full dowry. The youngest daughter, Cordelia, who will be standing to the king's right, will be played by Deborah Murphy. Cordelia is not married, but is being courted actively by the Prince of Burgundy and the King of France. The other voice in the scene is that of Lear's longtime attendant and friend, the Earl of Kent, who will be played by yours truly, standing to Cordelia's right. The king's intent in retiring is to dispense with his official duties while retaining his title and a retinue of knights and living presumably very comfortably in the household of one of the daughters. Before doing this, however, he sees fit to engage in a final display of royal effrontery, a thinly veiled spectacle of self-interested power, designed on the one hand to secure his future welfare, and on the other to most conspicuously remind everyone who's the boss. Let's see how that works out for him.
Attend the lords of France and Burgundy, Gloucester. Meanwhile, we shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map there. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom, and 'tis our fast intent to shake all cares and business from our age, conferring them on younger strengths, while we unburdened crawl toward death. Our son of Cornwall, and you are no less loving son of Albany. We have this hour a constant will to publish our daughter's several dowers, that future strife may be prevented now. The princes, France and Burgundy, great rivals for our youngest daughter's love, long in our court have made their amorous sojourn and are here to be answered. Tell me, my daughter, since we now will divest us both of rule, interest of territory, cares of state, which of you shall say doth love us most, that we may our largest bounty extend where nature doth with merit challenge? Goneril, our eldest born, speak first.
Sir, I love you more than words can wield the matter. beyond what can be valued rich and rare. No less than life, with grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child e'er loved or father found. A love that makes breath poor and speech unable. Beyond all manner of so much, I love you.
What shall Cordelia do? Love and be silent.
Of all these bounds, even from this line to this, with shadowy forests and with champagnes rich, with plenteous rivers and white-skirted meads, we make thee, lady, to thine and Albany's issue be this perpetual. What says our second daughter, our dearest Regan, wife of Cornwall? Speak.
Sir, I am made of the selfsame metal that my sister is, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart, I find she named my very deed of love, only she comes too short. That I profess myself an enemy to all other joys which the most precious square of sense possesses, I find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness of love.
Then poor Cordelia, and yet not so, since I am sure my love's more richer than my tongue.
To thee and thine hereditary ever remain this ample third of our kingdom, no less in space, validity, and pleasure than that conferred on Gondor. Now, our joy, although the last not least, to whose young love the vines of France and milk of Burgundy strive to be interest, what can you say to draw a third more opulent than your sister's? Speak.
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nothing can come of nothing. Speak again.
Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more, nor less.
How, Cordelia, amend your speech a little, lest it may mar your fortunes.
Good, my lord, you have begotten me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back to you as are fit and right. Obey you, love you, and most honor me. Why have my sisters husbands if they say they love you all? Happily, when I shall wed, that lord whose hand must take my plight shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Sure, I shall never marry like my sisters, to love my father all.
But goes your heart with this?
God, my lord.
So young and so untender?
So young, lord, and true.
Let it be so. Thy truth, then, be thy dower, for by the sacred radiance of the sun, the mysteries of Hecate and the night, by all the operations of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I disclaim all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and meat, hold thee from this forever. The barbarous Scythian, or he that makes his generation messes to gorge his appetite, shall to my bosom be as well neighbored, pitied, and relieved as thou, my sometime daughter.
Good, my liege.
Peace, Kent. Come not between the dragon and his wrath. I loved her most, and thought to set my rest on her kind nursery. Hence, and avoid my sight. So be my grave my peace, and here I give her father's heart from her. Cornwall and Albany, with my two daughters' dowers, digest this third. Let pride, which she calls plainness, marry her. I do invest you jointly with my power, preeminence, and all the large effects that troop with majesty, ourselves by monthly course, with reservation of 100 knights, by to you be sustained, shall our abode make with you in due terms. Only we still retain the name and all the additions of the king. The sway, revenue, execution of the rest, beloved sons, be yours, which to confirm this coronet.
Royal Lear, whom I have ever honored as my king, loved as my father, as my master followed, as my great patron thought on in my
prayers. The bow is bent and drawn, make from the shaft.
Let it fall, rather, though the fork invade the region of my heart. Be Kent unmatterly when Lear is mad. What wilt thou do, old man? Think'st thou that duty shall have dread to speak when power to flattery bows? To plainness, honor's bound, when majesty stoops to folly, reverse thy doom, and in thy best consideration, check this hideous rashness. Answer my life, my judgment. Thy youngest daughter does not love thee least, nor are those empty-hearted whose low sound reverbs no hollowness.
Kent on my life no more.
My life I never held but as a pawn to wage against thy enemies, nor fear to lose it, thy safety being the motive.
Out of my sight!
See better, Lear, and let me still remain the true blank of thine eye. Now by Apollo, king, thou swear'st thy gods in vain.
O vassal miscreant!
Kill the physician! And the fee bestow upon thy foul disease. Revoke thy doom, or whilst I can vent clamor from my throat, I'll tell thee thou dost evil.
Hear me, recreant, on thine allegiance, hear me. Since thou hast sought to make us break our vow, which we durst never yet, and with strained pride, to come between our sentence and our power, which by nor our nature nor our place can bear, our potency may good take thy reward. 5 days do we allot thee for provision to shield thee from diseases of the world, and on the sixth to turn thy hated back upon our kingdom. If on the 10th day following thy banished trunk be found in our dominions, the moment is thy death. Away, by Jupiter, this shall not be revoked.
Fare thee well, king. Sit thou thus, wilt appear, freedom lives hence, and banishment is here. The gods to their dear shelter take thee, maid, that justly thinks and hast most rightly said. And your large speeches may your deeds approve, that good effects may spring from words of love. Thus Kent, O princes, bids you all adieu. He'll shape his old course in a country new.
Always wanted to have a screaming match with Volk. There's a fascinating moral psychology on display here. One in which something very much like the Didache's two ways stand in stark contrast. It's worth noting, both in fairness to the characters and for the sake of my argument, that this starkness waxes and wanes as the drama unfolds, as with most of our lives, goodness and malice frequently commingle. The philosopher Stanley Cavell has written that King Lear is a play in which each of the characters is either very good or very bad, yet one in which good must finally recognize and face its continuity with, its location within, a maze of evil, pointing to the archetypical conflict at the play's climax. He observes, if the Machiavellian fails in the end, he very nearly succeeds. And if the Christian succeeds, his success is deeply compromised. But this ambiguity is well cloaked in the play's opening scene. Lear's cruel game, of course, is not only a game, but a struggle between two ways of life or two habits of being. He has in mind a particular outcome, one that is in fact based in his genuine love for and trust in
one of his daughters, and yet he insists on getting to that outcome by way of asserting his will to power to manipulate the other players. Cavell suggests that Lear's behavior is motivated by shame, a fear of being revealed both publicly and to those nearest him as something besides the powerful Machiavellian persona who has for however many years successfully ruled Britain. Cavell calls shame the most primitive of social responses, arguing that it is felt not only toward one's own actions and one's own being, but toward the actions and the being of those with whom one is identified. Fathers, daughters, wives, the beings whose self-revelations reveal oneself. Because Lear cannot bear to show any hint of vulnerability, he demands of the one person who genuinely loves him something her virtue renders her unwilling to offer. Lear, at least as he behaves here, along with his older daughters whose behavior is consistent throughout the play, embodies what I call, I didn't make it up, I borrowed it from someone smarter, just like pretty much everything, a politics of security. That politics is founded on a thoroughgoing self-interestedness, although one fully capable of veiling itself for tactical reasons. Witness Goneril and Regan's effusive but completely disingenuous declarations of love for their father. It's characterized by a greed and acquisitiveness based on a fear of deprivation and a revulsion toward the possibility of being dependent, of being vulnerable. And because of this, it is compelled to regard others warily at best and not uncommonly violently. Sometimes even preemptively so, because the politics of security is quintessentially risk-averse. But what of the other way? The way the Didache calls the way of life. As you now well know, it resides at Lear's right hand in his daughter Cordelia and her ally Kent. It seems apparent at the scene's beginning that Lear quite well understands two things. That whatever expressions of affection his elder daughters offer in response to his bribe, and that is what it is, are going to be self-serving lies. And that Cordelia alone, whom he loves truly and deeply, genuinely cares for him and his future well-being. He's counting on her love for him, leading her to go along with his game, however unpleasant that going along might be. What he fails to anticipate is that the same virtue that enables Cordelia to love so irascible a character as him also demands from her truthfulness rather than flattery. The distinction between the two being the signal difference between real and ersatz love. She shocks him out of his self-satisfaction, Cavell says, precisely because he knows she's offering the real thing, something a more opulent third of his kingdom cannot, must not repay, putting on him a claim he cannot face. She threatens, he says, to expose both his plan for returning false love for no love and expose the necessity for that plan, his terror of being loved, of needing love. Lear cannot abide being so shamed by his youngest child, and the ensuing rage through which he disowns Cordelia and banishes Kent proves to be not simply his own undoing, but that of all the others as well. In a stunning sentence, for me at least, Cavell accounts for Lear's actions by saying, "For some spirits, to be loved knowing you cannot return that love is the most radical of psychic tortures." Of Cordelia, Cavell says that all her words are words of love. To love is all she knows how to do. That's her problem, and at the cause of the tragedy of King Lear. As one whose love is genuine, complete, and without condition, Cordelia, and to a lesser extent, Kent, embodies what we can call a politics of charity, or caritas, or a politics of love. Love, as we've learned well from St. Paul, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Above all, love never ends. The foundation of the politics of charity is not quite the polar opposite of the politics of self-interest, because it calls into question the very nature of the supposedly self-interested self. From the perspective of the politics of charity, we are not isolated individuals, but members of one another, inextricably interdependent, quite literally having all things in common that most of us occasionally, frequently, or most of the time ignore or deny. This makes it no less true. Cavell, who's rightly wary of over-theologizing the play, concedes that this is the one way in which Cordelia is most definitively Christ-like. Her grace is shown, he says, by the absence in her of any unearthly experiences. She is the only good character whose attention is wholly on earth, on the person nearest her. The love at the bottom of the politics of charity seeks the genuine good of all whom it encounters. Just so, it entails an inherent vulnerability, one most obvious when the beloved is threatened or uncooperative or assumes the role of enemy. This is, of course, the love through which Jesus subjected himself to the cross, and the love which leads in the play's tragic conclusion to Cordelia's hanging and Lear's death from grief over all that he had wrought. Someone once told me that anytime one learns something, there are two questions to be asked: so what and now what? It's left for me to say a word about the practical significance of these lessons, about what they mean for our lives and for how we guide and care for those others whom God has placed in our lives, whether they're the children we've conceived and birthed or adopted and now are charged with raising, those in our congregations, Sunday schools, CCD classes, youth groups, those who wander our neighborhoods, and of course, all of those other folks whose lives, for whatever reasons, intersect with ours. How do we all learn together to embody the politics of love rather than the politics of security? My most honest answer to that question is, I don't know. Thank God for the second and third plenaries. My own children's goodness is as big an enigma to me as is the virtue of Cordelia, having been raised by King Lear. If I learned anything through the process of raising children, it's that apologizing, asking forgiveness, the vulnerability that entails, is sometimes the best we can do. Wittgenstein once said that nothing is so difficult as not deceiving oneself. Our love for the people in and around our lives, especially our children, is shot through with the potential for self-deception. It's not just worth asking, it's pretty important that we ask whether our affections are tainted by something other than love, something potentially harmful to ourselves and them, just to the extent it has more to do with security than love. I'm thinking here of our desire for them to experience the happiness that comes from having a successful life. A desire driven in part by the usually unspoken belief that their successes are emblems of our own. Most of us are aware of, and most of us think problematic, the baldest expressions of this in things like the preschool to Ivy League pipeline, personal trainers for pubescent athletes, or parents who call professors or teachers to complain about that prospect-destroying B+. My daughter Jessie calls these phenomena helicopter parenting on crack. Even though I recognize in myself the possibility of such behavior, I was my son's high school wrestling coach. I worry more about its gentler expressions. I want my children and my grandchildren, my students, the congregations to which I occasionally preach, you guys, to be happy. I wish good lives for all these, comfortable lives, pleasant lives, lives free from unnecessary suffering, lives filled with happiness. I wish this not simply because their lives will be read as markers of my own successes or failures, but because I genuinely care about them. I want them not to suffer. And yet, my feelings about these people, who I love or know I should love, are expressed uncomfortably well by Jim McCoy's blog post on the EP website 2 weeks ago. He was pondering the lives of his newly adult children and wonders whether they would live taking up the cross of discipleship or fall into being just a couple more of what James McClendon called half-Christians, busy about their own cares and wants, conform to the mores of this society or the fashions of this present age. Given the potential pain entailed by the former course, is the latter really so bad? McCoy understands the sentiment expressed by the concluding stanza of Lynn Powell's poem, Raising Jesus, where the author transitions from imagining Jesus' upbringing in Mary's household to thinking of her own young children. She writes, "Oh God, keep me a mediocre Mary. Dilute my children's love with selfishness. Let them refuse the treacherous kiss, never know the miserable cup. Make their lives long, happy, ordinary. And forgive the mother, reaching for your hymn, craving that miracle. Dilute my children's love with selfishness. That's a prayer that can be prayed apologetically only by those who understand the politics of charity and the risks associated with embodying it. And those dangers, along with The fact that any other way is ultimately not worth following. Find no clearer expression, I think, than the words of the late Herbert McCabe, Dominican friar and theologian, who said, "If you do not love, you will not be human. If you love effectively, you will be killed." As much as I want those I care about to be happy and successful, I think, I hope, I pray, I want more for them to be genuinely human. I want them to love, understanding that suffering may come along with that. May the grace and power of God make it so. Thank you. Amen.